Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready to take a bite out of the competition? Are you looking for ideas to make your business better? Welcome to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.
Sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
At the core of every successful business, you'll find people making a difference. And with each episode of the Core Business Show, we talk with those people, examine those ideas, and explore the strategies that make them special. Now, the host of the Core Business Show, Tim Jacquet.
Well, good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of the Core Business Show, focusing on small business on Blog Talk Network. This is Tim Jacquet, your host. Today, my guest, Jerry Smith. Jerry Smith is an author of Does God Give Us More Than We Can Bear? A Fatal Disease Survivor. If you'd like to speak to Jerry or speak to me, feel free to call in at 347-324-3460, 347-324-3460. Or you can go ahead and pose your question in the chat room if you're shy, and I'll go ahead and read the information out aloud to on the air. Or you can go ahead and post it into Twitter at @ApplesCapital. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Great. I guess to begin with, kind of tell us your story about yourself and how did you grow into writing this book?
Well, you know, I believe that the title that I ended up using was actually a statement or a question that I asked God many times throughout my life, mostly in anger when I would ask that question. But it started off, you know, from the very beginning. My grandmother died during childbirth. My mother was born a deaf mute and was abandoned because she was handicapped. When her mother died, her father... Oh, as I learned later on, in fact, last year even, he was one of these types that just had to start a new family immediately. And by that, I mean she had two brothers, and when he remarried in about 2 months, he shipped his two sons off to other family members that would take them. But nobody would take my mother because she was, quote, handicapped. And so eventually some people got made arrangements, and they sent her off to the school for the deaf. And so she stayed there till she was 18. When she left there, her mother and father, or stepmother and father, wouldn't take her in. So she got a job working as a live-in housekeeper. That's about the only thing she could do. She didn't know much. She couldn't speak or talk. And anyway, the homeowner raped her, and she became pregnant with me, and they still didn't take her. And so she got into a home run with mothers. And when I was born, nobody would still take her or myself. And so... she just took off and abandoned me there at the home for the unwed mothers, which they didn't raise kids. So that wasn't a very good situation. But then over the next couple of years, different people would arrange for me to go live with somebody. And then it seemed like each time it was less than 6 months, and they would get rid of me or whatever for some reason or the other. And so by the age of four, I finally was placed in the foster care program for Louisiana. And then when I grew up and graduated from high school and worked my way through college, and my senior year I got married. And then a few years later, my wife got involved in drugs and ended up this drug addict shot her to death. And so in the meantime, most of my life I've spent being, of course, angry and unhappy and depressed and just that kind of life all the time. And so I wasn't probably much fun to be around. But anyway, then a few years later, my grandson turned 15 on his birthday, of all things. His parents bought him a car, and he had his driver's permit. And they told him, of course, don't get on the freeway yet until an adult rides with you a few times. But obviously, as kids do, he went and got on the freeway that day on his birthday, and it was raining, and the car hydroplaned over into incoming traffic, and an 18-wheeler truck ran over him and killed him on his birthday. At that point, I attempted suicide because I was constantly fighting depression. And so then, now, by this time, I'm like 49 years old, And I had remarried and actually was giving my second wife a lot of trouble. And it was all me because of the fact that I started living with somebody that's just angry all the time and depressed all the time. And it takes nothing just to have you explode at every little thing. But she stuck with me. And so at about 49, when I attempted suicide, and there was a lot more reasons to that. There was my first in-laws, when they found out that it looked like we wouldn't get married, they had me investigated for whatever reason and determined that since I was an orphan, they would tell their daughter in front of me, look, you can't marry him, he's trash because he doesn't know who his parents are. And so needless to say, as so many kids do, we married in spite of them, you know. And they didn't even come to the wedding. So that was just typical of the fact that I was rejected from birth on up to even my second-in-laws reject me for about 15 years. I was married to my current wife. Now we've been married 37 years. And we were married about 15, 16 years before my mother-in-law finally accepted me. So I don't know what it is. But anyway, when I attempted suicide, I was in a coma for about 6 days. And when I came out, it was just, I guess that was enough. The attempted suicide was enough to, I guess, wake me up from all of the depression and everything I'd been living, the life I'd been living. And I just suddenly, for whatever reason, realized that, hey, it's time. I've got to do something to turn my life around. There's got to be happiness out there. I started with my wife encouraging me. We started visiting churches and then got into reading the Bible. And I came across this passage that, you know, that said, actually, the answer to happiness, which some people, I think, probably think this is too simple. But if you're suffering the kind of life I was from, suffering from anger and depression, and you hate, and the hate is because you hate about this that's done you wrong. And the Bible said that, you know, the only answer is got to forgive people, because if you continue to hold on to your hate, all you're doing is hurting yourself. You're not causing those people any problems. And you can't allow yourself to be happy because you're just eating up with. Oh, so I started trying to forgive. And a lot of people trying to help you and everything would just, oh, look, just make you a list and of names and forgive them, you know, and go right on. Well, life was never that simple. So it took me a couple of years as I would make the progress. But along the way, I started experiencing this feeling that, wow, what is it? It was a kind of happiness that I'd never experienced before. It was so deep, you know, and mm-hmm. it was deep. And so I was happy for about, I guess, about 11, 12 years. My wife and I mean, everything was just great. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say that our problems all disappeared. We didn't have problems anymore. No, we continue to have problems, and sometimes major problems, just like all other people do. You know, but this time with a different attitude, you could take them in stride. You know, it wasn't a do or die situation like it was when I was so angry and depressed. But anyway, so life was great. And then it came time when I was 64. I'd had a physical, and the doctors with x-rays had spotted some spots on my lungs and said, you need to see a pulmonary doctor. So I did, and then all of a sudden he was sending me to one test after another and another. And I didn't think there was really any problem at that point, because I had been a runner all my life, and I was running like 4 miles a day, 5 days a week, and I didn't notice any problems with the lungs at that point. But anyway, mm-hmm. so finally the doctor then nurse calls me and says, based on our tests so far, we want to put you in the hospital and have a lung biopsy. Now they got my attention, and I'm beginning to worry that, oh, maybe there is something wrong. And so when they did that, then before they'd see me yet, the doctor then wanted to, nurse told me they wanted to send it to the Mayo Clinic lab in Phoenix that does lab analysis. And they confirmed that the disease, I had an incurable lung disease called pulmonary fibrosis. And so when I sit down with my doctor, my wife's with me, we sit in his office, and he explains that it is incurable. There is no medicine, no treatment, nothing. There's no research being done as far as he knows. And the doctors don't know what causes pulmonary fibrosis, so there's nothing to do. And meantime, I'm pushing this guy for some answers, for some medicine or something, because and he keeps telling me there's nothing. And I think the doctor gets maybe a little aggravated because I can be a little pushy. And so finally, he
one answer.
Look, yeah, he said, look, you have a death sentence and there's no hope. He used those actual words.
Wow.
And I mean, it just stunned me. And then when he shut up. And I said, well, what did I do? I mean, how much time do I have then? And then that's when he said, well, based on my experience and the fact that we really don't have any information about this disease, but the fact that the Mayo Clinic lab is confirmed, my opinion, he says, I think probably you have between 6 months and 2 years. And again, this bedside manner was fantastic. I mean, he said, and if I was a betting man, I would bet it would be closer to 6 months than 2 years. Well, I mean, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to just destroy people? I mean, their hope completely? You know, and so, man, I'm just, my heart just sinks. And I'm just, I can't even explain the feeling. All of a sudden, I'm both angry, I'm depressed, I'm raging, and I'm in my mind, I'm already blaming God, you know, for letting me get this disease. And so I asked the doctor, I said, well, what am I supposed to do? He says, well, go home and wait for the end. If you're still alive in 6 months, come back for another breathing test. And that's where you breathe into a computer and they measure your lung capacity, which tells them, you know, the extent or the scope. Now, my disease was evidently so rampant that that you could almost measure the loss of lung capacity just on a daily basis. I was down to 60% just in a very short time. That's why the 6 months. And at 60% lung capacity, so I said, but I don't. Well, what am, you know, and you're frustrated, and you're really well. You know, if you've ever been told that you're about to die just in time, well, you just can't imagine what you know. You want information. You want to know there's hope, there's help, there's something. And so anyway, the doctor, well, I'm sorry, just. You just, whatever you've been doing up till now, just go home and continue doing that. That's all I can tell you. So whatever you're doing, just bide your time, you know. So we go home on a Friday evening, and my emotions are just raging. They're just going up and down, and just I'm just bouncing. And I go off in my room and close my door, and I am, and then I get so angry that I actually scream at God. God, why did you allow this to happen to me? Don't you think I've had more than my fair share, and that caused me to sit down and just start thinking all the way back to my grandmother, like I had mentioned here a few minutes ago. And step by step, I remembered each of these steps I went through, and I blamed God for every step of the way. Look at why this, you know, and I was just raging. Well, I probably spent 40, 45 minutes going through my entire life that evening. But then when I got back to the present time, it was like maybe I was just totally calm. The anger was gone. Everything was gone. I was just tranquil, calm, peaceful. It's like I almost had a blank mind. And when I look back at that, I believe that was actually God's purpose for me to do that, because I had to get all of this out of my system so that I would have an open mind to be able to function and try to figure what is it that I could do. Because the first thing that went through my mind was that, look, as you've just remembered, you've been through a lot and you've never given up. Are you going to give up now? Mm-hmm. And I said, no way, I'm not going to give up now. I'll at least go down fighting.
Absolutely.
And so with an open mind and a calm mind, I was able to think rationally. And I guarantee you, when you are ranting and raving and angry, so angry that you could just, you know, knock a hole in the wall and all of these things, you can't think. And so I'm thinking, I said, well, what is it that I could do or anybody could do that say doesn't have a lot of money or anything? Well, the immediate thought was, well, we could all at least get on the internet and start searching for information about your disease, about treatment, about research about just everything. And so that's what I did. And I did this for 2 weeks, and it was, everything was a, dead end, dead end, dead end. And typically, like I guess any other human being, after a day or two of it, I would get very discouraged and be ready to give up. And I've done this throughout my life. But I always, the next day, I was always ready to go again. I was like recharged, my battery. And so then I would start again. And I went on like this for about 2 weeks. And as we all know, I mean, you can put any kind of words in, say, Google, and it'll come up with something. And so that's what I was doing after I ran out of information. And I didn't know anything about pulmonary fibrosis. I'd never heard of it. Well, after 2 weeks, I'd probably put every word, every combination of words that I could possibly think of in relationship to that. And everything was a zero. Like the very first thing I Googled was the Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation of Europe. Well, all it said was the fact that this is an untreatable, incurable lung disease. There is no known cause. There's no research being done at this time. And the average lifespan worldwide is 7 years. Well, that was it. So anyway, I kept running into that and those kind of things, and nothing. So after 2 weeks, I was pretty much exhausted as to coming up with anything, and I was now ready to give up. I said, this is it. But, and I guess I had sat there for a little while and really desperately wanting to think of something, and suddenly, and you can make out of it, anybody can make out whatever their beliefs are. They can have an opinion about this. But suddenly the thought just popped in my mind. Why don't you try searching for a doctor that has his own laboratory? And that
Absolutely.
I hadn't done. It never crossed my mind. And so I did that. And in a couple hours, I found a doctor in Germany that had started his own laboratory 25 years ago, mainly for cancers and AIDS, and he had gotten a pretty good rate of curing a lot of different kinds of cancers. So now I feel very optimistic suddenly, and he also spoke broken English, which means I was able to ask him on the telephone. And so now I'm thinking, hey, there's a chance, there's some hope here. And so I asked Dr. Keith, I said, what do you know about pulmonary fibrosis? And he said, well, I know nothing about it except that I know that it's incurable. Well, that was strike one. I said, well, you understand now you've done 25 years of research, extensive cancer research. Could that not maybe benefit my disease? I would assume all cancers would have, a correlation of relationships. And he says, I don't really think so. Strike two. And I said, well, Dr. Keith, do you know of any colleagues, or have you heard anything, or you get your medical papers, or your ear to the ground, all these things that doctors do to know if anybody's doing research, anybody's treating a patient, a pulmonary fibrosis patient, anything? He said, I'm sorry, Jerry, but I have not heard of anything. This is practically an unknown disease. Strike three, I'm out. And I just sunk. I mean, I kind of just crashed, kind of caved in. And I'm just sitting there. I'm at a loss for words. I can't think of anything to say. I don't know what I'm. It's just very frustrating, at that point. And he hadn't said anything. And now this seemed like an eternity, but it was probably a minute. In reality, it was probably a minute or so. And suddenly he spoke up first. And I think that he probably heard the agony in my voice, the passion, whatever. And he suddenly said, well, Jerry, look, if you would be willing to send me 20 cc's of your blood, I'd be willing to analyze it. And if I could find a culprit, he called it, I'd be willing to research that quite extensively and see if there's any way I could come up with a serum that might help you some. Let me tell you right now, I don't think there's any way that I could cure you. I just want to warn you about that. He says, but I kind of think that I could improve the quality of your life somewhat, like maybe extending your life some, that type of thing. And so that started the process. And now I'm feeling really excited. And Mm-hmm. And that starts the process of, and you would think, I would assume, like most people would assume, that, hey, it's just a simple matter to run to your doctor and say, doctor, draw 20 cc's of my blood and put whatever you have to put in so that it can make a two-day shipment, you know, trip and not spoil or anything. And that would be bad. Well, there's a lot to learn about the medical profession in this country because, number one, every doctor I went to, of course they want to know, why do you want your blood drawn and given back to you? And so you got to explain. I went to 8 doctors in 2 weeks because it takes time to get an appointment and get in there and talk to them. 8 doctors turned me down. Now, that seems unbelievable. But anyway, and so of the 8 doctors, most of them would use the excuse, well, we can't do that. That's outside the AMA, the American Medical Association, outside the box. That'll remark you here. And my research since then has showed me that today less than 25% of American doctors belong to the AMA anymore. And I've heard it's because of all kinds of reasons. They're frustrated with the organization. They're frustrated with some of the rules. They're frustrated with, you know, things that are happening inside the AMA. But anyway, that was the biggest excuse. And then another one said, look, that's a waste of your time and money. You don't want to do that. And I'm getting frustrated. Anyway, and I said, wait a minute. Now, you tell me that's a waste of my time. I might be living on 6 months. And I better watch my time and not take any chances. I mean, you sound stupid to me. And wasting my money, why wouldn't I try? I mean, what am I going to do, save my money and take it with me? But my favorite excuse of all, believe it or not, was this doctor, you know, actually said, look, you don't want to do that. That's voodoo medicine.
Wow.
That doesn't seem possible in this country, I mean, today.
Well, yeah, it's just a conventional way of thinking. Can I tell the audience, listening audience, what is the pulmonary fibrosis?
Fibrosis. Okay, it's a lung disease that it's a member of the autoimmune system family of diseases. That means things that will attack the autoimmune system, because most people know that is your body's last line of defense is your autoimmune system. And mm-hmm. It appears that in the years since then, I've learned through a lot of research that is now the fastest growing family of diseases is autoimmune related. And what that means is that it's all geared back to, in my opinion, pollution. You can get it from drinking, eating, breathing. So what does that mean? It means the polluted air, the polluted surface, the polluted foods and things from, you know, how man has polluted the earth. And so, so therefore, I can understand now why doctors don't really know what causes it. And in my opinion, there could be dozens and dozens of things that cause it. It can be funguses. It can be just anything. And because there's so many different things, how are you going to sit down? Like in a lot of diseases, they can sit down and research one or two things, you know, trying to find how to beat that. But when it's this, and so I don't know if you keep up with, looking at all the statistics, but I mean, mm-hmm. it seems to be rampant today. How many people are dying from lung cancer and lung diseases of all kinds? And I believe most of them are getting it from either, some of them maybe from smoking. I never smoked. From smoking, mm-hmm. from inhaling these different kind of products, you know, chemicals and things, and they said even in your insulation, all kinds of things. So you can get it from drinking, eating, breathing. And so that's the best opinion I have. Pulmonary fibrosis normally attacks mostly senior citizens, and then I finally figured out why that is, because based on studies, your autoimmune system is a pretty tough part of your body, and it just takes years and years and years for anything to destroy your autoimmune system or to break it down. So you're going to be attacked at any age of life, maybe, and it could take 10, 20, 30 years before it, you might say, wore down your autoimmune system. My doctor said that this fungus, I had a fungus from the tree family. And that is, in, if you live in the woods or, you know, in the country where you're under trees all the time, if you're familiar with it, you know, throughout the change, seasonal changes, you can see trees emitting these different kinds of spores and things that you can see floating in the air, you know, at different seasons. He believed that I actually contracted some spores that actually entered my body through my gums and went into my autoimmune system. And so over a period of who knows how many years, when it finally broke that down, then it attacks your lungs. And where this disease hits your lung, it turns that spot into like a scar tissue type material to where you can't get air through there and it's not reversible. So I've lost about 42 or 43% of my lung capacity permanently. But he cured, the doctor cured that fungus. Now, you know, there's a lot of controversy out there. So many people, including myself, will say, I was cured of pulmonary fibrosis. No, you're not cured of pulmonary fibrosis. That's not a disease. Pulmonary is your chest area. Fibrosis is merely your lungs turning into a dead material, fibrosis type of material. You see what I'm saying? So what you're cured of, if you are cured, is a disease that attacked the lungs, turning parts of it into a fibrosis. And I find in my situation, it takes too long most times to try to really explain what I was cured of. So out of habit, I say I was told I was the first known person in the world that's ever been cured of pulmonary fibrosis. My doctor in Germany laughs about it from time to time and says, Jerry, you were my guinea pig. But, you know, I don't know to this day, and it's been 4 years ago next month that I was cured of the fungus, and I don't think he has got anybody else yet that has been totally cured. There's some that are going through different phases or stages of the medicine because depending on your body and the extent of your disease, how far it has progressed, it can take, you know, different lengths of time. For me, it took 16 months. I took 2 8-month batches before I was cured 4 years ago.
Wow. So where you find your strength? You've gone through a lot of adversity during life. You name it. It looked like things just come and attack you. Where do you find your strength, personally?
Well,
to go on.
I think, you know, for me personally, it all comes down to faith in God and what I've learned, and I believe what I've learned. And that is, and I wasn't, but the funny thing was I wasn't a believer growing up. But in getting grown and studying the Bible and everything, I do believe with all my heart now that God has a purpose for every human being. And
Absolutely.
He knows that purpose before you're born. He knows that purpose. And he knows what your life's going to be. With the only exception being that, in my opinion, is that, but number one, when God is ready to show you your purpose, number one, you got to be listening. Because obviously, if you're not listening, you're not going to get the purpose. Number two, you've got to accept that purpose if you hear it. And so I believe that God, his purpose was for me to experience my entire life so that I could then turn around and start talking to people and showing people and explaining to people that there is hope, you know, by having faith, you know, and, in my opinion, by helping yourself. Now, and anyway, so I think that part of it was that I believe God gave me from birth a very stubborn attitude, you might say. Stubborn in the sense that I would never give up. I just, no. And there's stories like, for example, when I left that one foster home, the farmers and the cotton farmers, and I had picked cotton for 3 summers for the neighbors after we picked our cotton and being paid $1 per 100 pounds of cotton picked. And I saved enough in 3 years, and he was, the foster father was holding the money to get a bicycle. Well, when it was time for me to leave there and go somewhere else, I'd take my bicycle And he said, no, that's not your bicycle. He said, I bought that bicycle. It's for foster kids. Well, anyway, so I know that I looked him right now, and I'm only 10 years old. I said, look, when I'm grown, I'm coming back here one day, and I'm going to kill you. It was that kind of stubborn, you know, attitude. And I'm not saying I wasn't proud of that or anything, and of course I was just an angry young kid. There were so many different kinds of things where that I was very stubborn, but that stubbornness helped me. That was kind of an example that I would always think that when I'm grown, I'm going to have something. When I'm grown, I will live. When I'm grown, it'll be my time, that kind of attitude.
Wow. That's amazing. In your book itself, you have a foreword that was done by Zig Ziglar. I mean, gosh, how in the world did you get Zig Ziglar to write a foreword for your book?
Well, when I left accounting, I worked my way through college and got an accounting degree, and I hated accounting. But anyway, I found that in real estate. It was that same old story that back then, when you don't have parents, and maybe it applies to a degree, you don't have parents, you don't have somebody that works with you when you're going off to college to say, do you know what you want to do? Do you know what you want to take and all these things? All I thought was that here I was alone with no parents, that I had to go to college, I had to get a degree. And so when I'd go down there each semester and register, I didn't know what to register for. But you have to pick a major, right? So I would just decide on one in that line when you're about to run out of time and you got to pay and get your books. And so for four semesters, I just picked something at the last split second and didn't like any of them. And so in the fourth one, I'm halfway through college, I'm saying, wow, you know, I'm going to have so many hours here and can't graduate. I've got to get something to get out of college. And so the fourth one was I was just desperately trying to come up with something. And I remember in high school that I had taken a bookkeeping class and I aced it with no problem. Well, I'll do that. And so I ended up taking 4 years of college. Four years of accounting in 2 years and one summer semester just so I could graduate. But then for 10 years out of college, I tried eight different accounting fields. Well, that will tell you that I was trying to find one I could stand. I hate the hall. And so finally I went into real estate. Well, brand new in real estate, I mean, the first month, this realtor had a speaker come to the office meeting and motivation, you know. And it was this guy by the name of Zig Ziglar, and he was just starting out. And I don't know how good he was. Compared to today, he wasn't that good. Anyway, he was selling tapes, and so out of desperation to succeed in real estate, I bought his tapes, bought everything. I bought his new book, which it was just coming out. It was my first one. Well, and then I studied the book. I wore his materials out, but I kind of lost contact with him for 27 years, whatever. Then when I came out of the hospital and I started looking for a church and something, I visited several churches, and I went in this one church and didn't know anybody, and I saw this big crowd down in the auditorium. But some said, hey, go down and see who it is. They're standing around somebody. And I just sit there and start listening to him. He taught Sunday school classes for 20 years. Well, I joined that church right then and there because of Zig Ziglar, and I joined his Sunday school class and went for 12 years until he had to retire because he's suffering from dementia or something now. And so I started visiting with him. I found my copy of his book from 30 years ago by then and got him to autograph it, and we became friends, and he learned about my life, and he started encouraging me to write a book. And then when I was diagnosed with pulmonary fibrosis, his oldest, Susan, died of pulmonary fibrosis 15 years ago. And it just made us bond. And, you know, and Zig Ziglar, he was one of the most expensive, highest-paid motivational speakers. And he traveled all over the world trying to find a cure for her, and he couldn't. Now, why does God let somebody, one person, you know, find a cure in somebody else when both people were trying to do God's purpose? And you know, and so after that, Zig, he just insisted every Sunday, I had to write that book. I had to get a book out to help people. And then after I was cured, about 2 or 3 weeks later, I got my first call from a man that had lung cancer. Heard about my cure. Can I help him? I started getting calls, several calls a week, and I don't know where they came from. I believe it was God, God motivated, and I believe that's what my purpose was. He had me live my entire life, and I never had any feeling of needing to write the book until I got the disease, though, and became the first known person cured of it. And then I could see that's when even God started. I could feel telling me that I need to write a book, and I need to get out there and talk to people and tell people there is hope, and to show them how they can also help themselves by going overseas and trying conventional medicine and so forth. Put this work together, and so the purpose that, and yourself, you know that, how many people come up to you and say, well, I'm sorry about your loss, I'm sorry about this or that or whatever, and I know how you feel when you know that particular person hasn't lost anybody or something. They're being polite, but sometimes it bothers you because you don't give them credibility because you know they didn't experience it. So how could they feel what you feel? But in my case, I have felt almost everything out there, including the death sentence. And so I feel like when I talk to you or somebody, they can believe me when I say I understand what you're going through and I think there is hope. And some of us can be helped and some might not be, but we all have a chance if we have hope and faith and then try, some of this unconventional, medicine. So that's the reason I believe the purpose.
Wow, that's an amazing story. In your everyday life, as you go through this journey, have you done thousands, well, a lot of interviews, book signings? And, I mean, I'm looking at everything on your website. What will you say to a person that called you and offered them a sense of hope? Hey, this is, you know, here's an option here. Explore this option. And do you refer them to your doctor in Germany or some other resources outside of the U.S.?
Yes, I do. The first thing I tell them is, look, I said, I don't know what your faith is, but I believe that most people believe in a God. Now, I personally believe in Jesus Christ, but you have to have faith and hope in something, in a God. I mean, you need it for strength. And God, I believe God wants us to treat him just like he's our father and like you would talk to your father here on earth and hey, Father, I got this problem, I got that problem. Can you help me and talk to him and ask for help? But have this faith and hope and strength. So it gives you strength to go on while you're looking for to help yourself also. And I said, and I don't care what your situation is, financially or otherwise, I don't think there's any point in you when I've talked to a person. I don't believe there's any point in you getting 4, 5, 6, 8, 9, 10 more opinions in your neighborhood, in your town, because they're all going to be the same. It is so worthwhile for you to get at least a second opinion overseas from somebody that is curing and doing things, like my doctor in Germany. Oh, there's no obligation. You can send your blood over there, and for about $400, he'll analyze it and give you an opinion if he thinks he can help you and what we can do. I said, it's worth that. And you have no obligation to ever use him or get the medicine. But it is so worthwhile, to get this second opinion and see if you have more hope. And don't listen to your doctors. I said, this is the thing that just infuriates me. Don't listen to those doctors that are so insensitive that tell you, say, look, there's no hope. Just go home and you just go and wait. Just don't listen to those. Don't believe them.
Don't listen.
Get another doctor. If that's the way to talk to you, find another doctor that will at least have a little bit of sympathy, empathy for you, but also help yourself. There are three major countries in this world right now that I know of that are really doing tremendous research into unconventional medicines. And of course, Germany is the biggest, but now Russia and China have gotten very big in it. And I understand just recently that Israel is coming, getting pretty strong in it. So you got all these countries. And my research shows me, Tim, this is amazing. The research I've done here shows me that the answers that you a lot of times you'll get, why isn't the United States doing the same unconventional research program to the extent that's being done overseas? And you know the answer I get? We can't afford it in this country anymore. Hey, come on. What do you mean we can't afford it? We're probably sending the money overseas that they're using to do their research.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
we
can't afford to do
a lot of other countries and give them blank checks of this and that.
And we can't do it for our own people? Come on.
Do you think it is the profession. Do you think there's an underlining reason why the government can't afford to do the research? Of course, we're going to be faced with a lot of budget cuts and research and development is usually the first thing that goes. Look what happened to NASA. They don't know what to do with their space program because they just don't – they can't safely put the old shuttle fleet back in space. They have to build new ones, which costs – multi-billions of dollars. Do you think if there's the industry is suppressing that or is walking a fine line of if it's profitable for me, I will support it. If it's something that's going to cost me and I have to speculate, I'm not going to do it. Do you think it is the industry or do you think
okay,
it
I'm
is
not
the...
Going to, I'm not going to make any accusations, but I will throw some things at you that I have seen now. I'm 72 years old, and I've been reading this and seeing this for 15 to 20 years. Tell me why you think that the pharmaceutical industry still lobbies Congress to the tune of about $3 to $4 billion a year. What does the pharmaceutical industry want from Congress if they give them $3 to $4 billion a year? You know, I guess my... saying, I think to a degree there is somewhat of a conspiracy maybe. These drug pharmaceutical companies, they want the Congress to vote the way that the pharmaceuticals want them to vote, in controlling laws, in controlling what you can and can't do. And I really believe that it is to protect the pharmaceutical industry, and their only goal is to sell medicine prescriptions. And they don't want cures, in my opinion. I know this is only my opinion.
Sure. No problem
whatsoever. And they've been doing it for 20 years that I know of. So I believe that, you know, everybody that lobbies Congress, they want something for their money, don't they?
Absolutely. What it's for them, bottom line. Going back real quick, because you have an amazing story I think you share with us for the past 40 minutes, I'm going to ask you about a couple things. You know, if you have given this amazing ministry to people in your book, is global, if there is a bucket list that you have in, for number one, what will it be? And then number two, from 100 years from now, from all the work that you've done, how would you like to be remembered 100 years from now? And then any closing comments that you might have?
Well, I really, in the last 12 months of how emails and letters I'm getting from people saying, thank you, Jerry, for this information. Thank you for helping me. I believe that if you hadn't have encouraged me to try this doctor, this medicine, I wouldn't be alive today. Those things make me so happy. They give me such great feeling that I'm at the stage that, you know, I don't even care about the money. I'm not making any money. I give more books away than I sell, and sell some. I'm just trying to recoup some costs, but I don't care. All I live for is I want to help people. I want to tell people. I just want people to know there is hope and that some can be cured, some won't be. But that's all I'm living for now, basically, is to reach out there and help people. That's what I'm doing, and I am blessed. I mean, there's so many days that I may be an impatient person and nothing happens for a week, and I feel kind of low, you know, down a little bit, and I'll get an amazing email, and my day is just gotten so much that I'm floating, you know, on air. And I just say, wow, that's what I'm living for, and that's what it's all about for me. And I just, only frustration that I experienced in the last year is that I can't reach enough people. I need bigger media, bigger outlets to reach more people. I'm doing everything for free. I just need, and I want to be remembered because I feel like that I grew up in I didn't have parents. Nobody ever said, no, we're proud of you. And there was never any recognition in these kind of things. And I found out that really all human beings, I don't care what they say, they all want to be appreciated and respected if they're truthful. And I never had growing up, never had this good job, great job, Jerry, or, you know, that kind of thing. And now that I'm getting that, it's like I'm working to have the satisfaction of knowing I help people. And I'd like for, you know, to be remembered as a person that really just gave it all he had the last few years of trying to just let me tell you just one quick thing, and that was the after about the first 6 months of talking to people, and so many people are skeptical, so many people would say, but what guarantees is there? I said, there are no guarantees in life. Come on. There's no guarantees that you can be cured. I mean, what's your life worth to you to go and try? You can't wait for guarantees. Anyway, so I would get frustrated because people didn't do anything, and they're procrastinators and things. So one day, I was talking to Zig Ziglar. I said, I expressed my frustration, and Zig said, Jerry, you're looking at this all the wrong way. He said, your job, God is expecting you to reach out to as many people as you can and offer them the help and the information and everything. Then what they do with that is between them and God. You need to not worry about them anymore and move on and keep telling others. And since then, I don't get frustrated anymore.
Wow. That's an awesome. That's really, really awesome. I really appreciate the time you took to come on the show, Jerry. You've given us a whole lot of wealth of information and an awesome story that hopefully can inspire some other people to step forward.
One quick thing. My website, www.jerrysmith.org, it's pages. Mm-hmm. One page is pulmonary fibrosis and other diseases. It is a full page of all kinds of information about the doctor, how I found it, how I went over, how I took the medicine. And it's got the doctor's assistant's name and email address. If somebody wants an opinion, you know, all they got to do is send that email to Sabine Eichhorn. Send an email, tell her what your diagnosis is, what the doctor thinks the degree is. She talks to Dr. Keyes. He will then have her send you the paperwork that you need to take to go get your blood drawn. They can download that information for free.
Wow.
It's just to help people.
And that's jerrysmith.org is your website.
Yes. It's there for free, and that's why it's posted. Just get it and go do something. That's what it frustrates me if you won't help yourself.
Okay. And any do you have a Twitter account or email if they have any email questions, if they can't reach your website?
Yes, jerry@jerrysmith.org. I'll make it real simple. Email jerry@jerrysmith.org and website jerrysmith.org.
Great.
I've got the phone number. And I'm happy. If they need to call me because they don't understand something, they can feel free to call.
Okay. And your telephone number?
214-681-5377, the number you called. That's the number I use for everything. 214-681-5377.
Okay, I got the last question real quick regarding your I have a person asking about how did you publish your book. Did you self-publish it or did you publish it through?
No. I didn't know how to write it. I didn't know how to do anything. And everybody said, well, you can't get it published. You can't do anything. I went on the internet, didn't know what to do about anything. And as I was looking through there, I believe that God led me to this particular one that said it was a Christian publishing company, Christian oriented. So I wrote about 4 pages. It was all I did of a manuscript, knowing that I would be turned down. And then I'd be finished. I tried, okay? God would have to leave me alone now. And so I sent it. After a few days, I forgot all about it. 7 weeks later, I get a contract, a FedEx package with a contract. The letter says, wow, we love your story, even though it's 4 pages. We've enclosed the contract. We want to publish your book. And they published it. And everybody says, that's impossible. It was not self-published. My third book is coming out this fall. And we're working on the title right now. But my second book, the one that they can get now, is one I rewrote because it's got stories from the first one coming out. And it made Amazon's bestseller since July 21st of last year. But in that one, I was singing real quick. I'll try to do this real fast. I was singing at the breakfast table one morning. I do this from time to time. I told my wife, I said, yeah, I wish I had some blood relatives, some biological relatives. And it was just the Pennsylvania market. It was gone. At 8 o'clock that morning, 1 o'clock that very same day, my wife and I are driving somewhere, and I get this phone. Says, is this Jerry Smith who wrote the book? This guy gives us more than we can bear. And I said, yes. She said, I'm your first cousin from Bastrop, Louisiana. The same day. And I said, no, how do I know? And she said, well, last week I went online to do some research on a James Slack Pickett. And she says, we've done genealogy in this family back to the 1600s. Each generation has been faithful to pass it down, keep it current. It's my time. I wanted some more information on my great-grandfather. And when I Googled his name, came up was, Does God Give Us More Than We Can Bear? By author Jerry Smith. In his book, he talks about his great-grandfather, James Slack Pickett. It's the chills. And that was
wow.
me. First cousins. Same day, I said, I wish. And then another quick thing, Zig Ziglar. When I finished my manuscript, I was very concerned about it. I didn't know how to write or do anything. And I was just really worried about how bad it would be. And so, Friday night, I told my wife, I said, yeah, I wish I could get somebody that's real experienced to read my manuscript and give me an opinion. I said, I'd love for Zig to do it. He's written about 29 books. And but I said, no, everybody is around Zig all the time wanting something. I don't want to be like the rest of them. She said, you're right. I don't think we should bother him. So, but every Sunday, he would ask me how my book's coming along. So that next morning, now this is Saturday night, Sunday morning, I'm sitting there, and Zig said, well, how's the book, blah, blah, blah. I told him he was ready to be a publisher. He said, well, Jerry, I would consider it a privilege if you would allow me to read your manuscript before you send it to the publisher. Wow, was God listening to me Saturday night and wow. talked to Zig for me? And then a few minutes later, he said, and you know, Jerry says, if you would like, I'd be happy to write your foreword. Well, when I was going over my to-do list with the publisher, as a first-time author, they had a checklist and to see what was going to be. And they said, well, you'll probably have this. You probably won't have this. You won't have this, probably. You probably won't have a foreword. I said, I have one. She says, oh, you do? Who wrote it? I said, Zig Ziglar. And she went quiet for a while. She went quiet, just totally quiet for a moment. And then she says, do you realize that people like Zig Ziglar don't write forewords for people like you? Now, she wasn't being ugly, but it kind of came across that way, it seemed. And that's what he did. And so I told Zig the next Sunday, and he says, well, they just don't understand friendship, do they?
Wow, that's awesome.
And there's so many more stories. The book is full of things that have happened since the first book was out. I've got pictures of my family. So I went to when I went to Bastrop, that was 2 weeks before Thanksgiving. And so we went down there, and I had between 50 and 60 blood relatives down there. And went down there and met a lot of them and got pictures. And one of them was a picture of my grandmother. I had never, ever seen her, or a picture of her, ever. And now that picture's in the new book.
Wow, that's really an amazing story. Anything you want to close with?
That's it. Don't ever give up hope.
Don't
let your doctor destroy your hope. Because if you give up hope, you almost don't have a chance.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And look overseas. Get on the internet and look overseas. You can help yourself to a degree.
Okay. No problem. I really appreciate that. I'm going to play a clip off of your website, about your book. Thank you for joining the program, Jerry. I really appreciate your time coming on. And
I wish you the best in your ministry.
Okay.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it so we can get more words out. Thank you very much, Tim. I thank you and appreciate it so much.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Okay. I'm going to play a short clip, if you guys don't mind, of the publisher house is Tate, but it's by Jerry Smith book called Does God Give Us More Than We Can Bear? So bear with me 1 second. We'll load up that real quick, that that clip, and we're going to play it out. Another production of Apple Capital Group, the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. Thank you for listening. Everybody have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. For a free quote on equipment leasing and financing, visit our website, applecapitalgroup.com. That's applecapitalgroup.com. And fill out the information to receive your free quote. We hope you'll join us for our next episode. And remember, you can always get to the Core via iTunes. You'll find all our previous episodes there. Thanks again for listening to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.